to tell you a little bit about because Mr. Scriber said, well, Neil works in agriculture, and I do. But also, I don't have my bachelor's degree is not in agriculture. As I said, it was in marketing. But then I went to University of Missouri and started working on a degree in ag economics, and I grew up on a farm. But while I was working at University of Missouri, I met Dr. William Albrecht, who is probably one of the, he died in 1974, but this was in 66 to 68. Dr. Albrecht was probably one of the best-known soil scientists of his time around the world. I happened to be on the civilian work program instead of going to the military service at that time through the church, and Dr. Albrecht's office was on the first floor of Mumford Hall. My office was on the second floor, and I got to know him as a result and was able to take a private study course under him in terms of soil fertility and agriculture, and that's what I still work in. I would like to say that I learned the chemistry of agriculture from there, but I also learned the environmental aspects of agriculture by being at Big Sandy from 68 to 72 at the same time as Mr. Scriber was there, and worked in the agriculture department. If it hadn't been for the agriculture department at Big Sandy, I don't believe I'd be doing what I'm doing today. So I just want to give credit where credit's due. Mr. Dale Schurter and the crew there certainly were a big help. But in my work with farmers and gardeners and growers from all over the world, we work in about 65 countries. Actually, when I say that, we receive soil samples and make recommendations for fertility for people in about 65 countries, and in some countries we actually receive more soil samples from those countries than we do some states in the United States. But our biggest income is from soil samples from California. I live in Missouri, but California is the biggest income and Missouri second. And then after that, New Zealand or South Africa, we get more samples from those countries than we do from any other state in the U.S. As far as the top 10, California, Missouri, Florida, Oregon, Maine, and, perhaps Iowa and Illinois would be in there for the top 10 states where we receive samples from. But in working with people in terms of their soils, and what we do is specialize in problem soils. If a person has a soil that they just can't solve the problem, and they think, well, we've done everything else, what can we do? Well, these are the kind of soils we take on to try to help them find out what's wrong, why things won't grow there. And as long as you have the proper climate and enough water, then we can straighten out whatever the other problems are. I mean, the reason we can is just because of following God's laws. Just follow the physics and the chemistry of the soil. And you can determine why a plant won't grow there. Because every soil needs the same amount of nutrients to grow the best plant. Every soil. And that soil, this is a quick course because it's not part of this sermon today, but that the most fertile soil has the very same makeup as the humus that we find in the soil. That's the best part for things to grow. What's humus? Humus is decomposed living matter, whether it's people or animals or plants or whatever. When you take living organisms and break them down to their smallest component, that's humus. When you take the humus and analyze the humus, it analyzes exactly the same chemistry as the most fertile soil. Now, when you consider that the dust of the ground is what we measure, it's not all the stuff that's in the soil, but only the very finest clay particles is what we measure and find out what kind of nutrients will that hold, because that's the only part of the soil that attracts and holds nutrients, is the very finest clay particle. When God says He made man from dust, He didn't just make us from the dirt. He made us from the dust, that very highest quality part of the soil. And when He made us that way, we have the very same makeup as when you analyze humus, which is the makeup of all living organisms. When you get the soil to match the makeup of humus, all of a sudden, whatever you're growing, whether it's a melon like we had back there, whether it's some type of a nut tree, whether it's fruits, whether it's vegetables, any one of those will always grow at their best. when they match the makeup of humus, which matches our makeup. Now, I can tell you that, but I will say that I've done this since 1973, and we've actually had people that we've worked with in terms of health. For example, a medical doctor in California, and he said, Neil, the problems that you tell me you're doing to straighten out my soil is exactly the same problems I have to use to straighten the health of people. And he said, if we could get our soils right, then what that says to me is we wouldn't have so many health problems. And then we could concentrate on accidents and birth defects and things like that, because he said, this is what I do. I analyze people to get them to stay well instead of being sick. Well, in my work with farmers and gardeners around the world, one thing stands out in the thinking of most who are involved in agriculture. It's an attitude that permeates not only agriculture, but all types of business, it seems. Because it's a concept that has been perpetuated from generation to generation, and it's not a concept that's advocated by God. Most people seem to live with this concept as an accepted part of life. I'll first present the concept in the form of a question. And here's that question. How little can I give and still get the most for it? Now, that is something that you face time and time again in this world. How little can I do and get the most for it? Now, that doesn't sound too bad if you say, how little can I give and still get the most for it? If, for example, you're thinking about going to trade your car in for another car, or if you're trying to find out, because you know, if you're going to buy a house, well, most people price a house as to what they want for it. That doesn't mean that's what they'll take for it. So if you're looking at it that way, that doesn't sound so bad. But this can sometimes lead to an even more dangerous concept. How little can I do and still get the most from it? That's the concept I'm talking about. How little can I do and still get the most from it? And that's what we see in agriculture, growing and marketing the food that we have to rely upon for sustenance. It isn't just in agriculture. As I say, we see it everywhere. Most people want as much as they can get for the least they can give. The farmer wants the highest yields possible. Most of the work we do is with farmers. The emphasis is generally on how much can I grow, the quantity and not the quality. Why? Because the average person will not pay the price it takes to add the quality that the farmer could give. I'll give you one example. Just to the south of Tucson, about 2 hours by plane, Hermosillo, Mexico, I have a client there. And this client grows 2,500 acres of grapes, table grapes, pecans, peaches, melons, and 100 acres of pomegranates. This man, well, I really don't know all of his background, but I met him at a conference, and he said, I'd like you to come down and help me with my crops. And when I got there, I was amazed, because as you drive down the road out of Hermosillo to go to his farms, well, all along the road, there's plastic and bottles and everything along the road. You know, just all kinds of trash. Just people thrown out. Nobody's cleaned it up. When you turned into the road to go to his farms, it was immaculate. Everything was picked up. The grass was mowed. The weeds were not there. The crops looked great. We got to his headquarters, and there were people everywhere. I thought it was a school. And in a sense, it is a school, but what it is, he says, all my labor comes from southern Mexico because all the people here go to the U.S. to work. So he said, I hire people from south Mexico, and they have to have a place to live. So in these complexes, he gives them a place to live and clean up, and they actually cook the food for them. He said, in my low season, we have 2,000 workers. In my high season, we have 3,000 workers. And they feed them all 3 meals a day in the cafeteria. And it's not bread and water. Because we ate lunch there one day, and for lunch, they had soup and a salad and a steak. and vegetables that were grown on their farms. And in this case, he said, we don't sell vegetables. We only grow them for the people that are here, but they're all organically grown vegetables. They grow that for their workers. Now, in his crops, he has some beautiful crops. And he had one grape, a table grape called Red Globe. And it's about, by the time it gets full grown, it's about this big around. It has four seeds in it. It clusters of them. And he says, Neil, we grow those red grapes, but nobody in Mexico and nobody in the United States will buy them. He says, all the people who buy for the grocery store say, the people won't pay, they won't pay the price for those. And he said, all those grapes, we load on trucks in Hermosillo and drive to Long Beach, California and put them on ships and ship them to Asia because the Asians will buy them. The people in Asia will buy them, but the people in the U.S., they're told, well, the consumers in the U.S. won't buy them. They have peaches, 500 acres of peaches, and those peaches get about 2.5 inches round. And when you eat one of those peaches, the juice will run down your arm. They're so juicy, and they taste sweet. And he says, we can't sell those to the buyers in the U.S. They won't buy them. They say, no, we don't want peaches like that. They won't last long enough on the shelf. People won't buy those kind of peaches from us. And he said, all those are hauled from here to Long Beach, loaded on a ship, and they're sent to Ireland and England because people there will buy those peaches and eat them. So all the good stuff's getting shipped someplace else because what the buyers are looking for is how little can I pay and how long will it last on the shelf. It's not how good does it taste. It's not how good is it for you. It's what's the least we can pay for the longest amount to sell so that we can sell them, they won't ruin so fast. Exactly the opposite to what Mr. Herbert Armstrong used to say. Buy something that will ruin and eat it before it does. You know. But today we're trying to, people are trying to get around that. But most farmers, because the men who buy for the big supermarkets, and I don't know about the number now, but the last time I saw, there were only 11 large supermarket chains that controlled the food business in the U.S. and Europe. 11. So that means 11 people determine what everybody else is going to eat if you buy from the big supermarkets. But they're looking for the items that will last the longest and sell for the lowest price. It isn't how it looks. Well, I mean, it is how it looks. It isn't how it tastes. It isn't whether it's nutritious. It's how it looks on the shelf. If it looks good, no matter what it tastes like or what it's good, whether it's good for you. Besides that, the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, says the plants grown on poor soil are just as nutritious as the plants grown on good soil. That's what they actually teach. I have a good friend in the church that has a Ph.D. in home economics, and she said that's what we're taught in home economics. That it doesn't make any difference whether it's good soil or bad soil. It's just a matter of what you put on. You know, how much can we take off? If it's a grape, it's a grape. One's as good for you as another. Well, I can tell you all you have to do is start analyzing the nutrient makeup of them and you can find out real quick. Grapes are, just because a grape looks good doesn't mean it's nutritious for you. But to add to this problem, the consumer is educated to believe that the government is watching out for our good when they promote cheap food. You know, you get sort of caught in a circle here or a cycle. The Council of Economic Advisors in the 1950s actually published in their manual that's published every year, they published that the policy of the United States was to produce food as cheaply as possible. It wasn't as nutritious as possible. It's how do we keep the price of food low? Well, when it comes to the farmer, he's been relegated to doing what he can to make things last. If nobody's going to pay for quality, then what do you have left? Only quantity. How much more can we produce? And as a result, most of the farmers that we work with don't really want to be large farmers. But they realize that at the prices they're being paid, if they don't have big acreages, they're not going to make enough to keep buying the machinery. I have one client that raises 2,000 acres of cotton, and about every 3 years he spends $1 million buying a new set of cotton pickers. You know, you got, if you're going to have, and he says, we got to have them Because if we can't get it out fast enough, then the quality goes down, or we lose it to the weather or whatever. So when it comes right down to it, all the things that the farmer has to buy, it's not like it used to be where you could buy smaller items and so forth. It's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Maybe out here you can still find small tractors, but the big tractor dealers back home, you don't find little tractors. You got to go to some specialty place in order to buy a small tractor anymore. But the farmer has been relegated to farming larger and larger acreages because the price that's paid to him won't sustain the costs he has otherwise. He just can't make it unless he's farming a large amount. There are very few farmers, unless they have a very high-priced product, that can make it anymore. Now, I'll tell you, we work with some consumer-oriented gardeners. I'd say they're small farmers, but they raise, if they're located close to a city, they'll actually raise vegetables and sell them to the people in the city, and they can make a good living on 25 acres. But you've got to have people that'll come pay you for the quality. In other words, people recognize these are good, and I want this. So it is possible. But for the farmer who's growing just wheat or corn or beans, it isn't. And the consumer who is educated to look for the lowest prices feels the government regulations will protect their rights and welfare, and they fail to see what the buyers and the marketers are doing to both sides, trying to push that price as low as possible so that the consumer pays a low price. Well, now we start sacrificing big grapes, juicy peaches, good taste, whatever it may be. But I'll just give you one example. Almost all the potato farmers in the United States have to sell their potatoes through 12 buyers. There are 12 companies that buy those potatoes. And we work with a lot of potato growers. And they'll actually sign a contract with the fellow growing potatoes. And if there's too many potatoes, they'll come back and say, well, we're just not going to honor the contract. And if they come and say, we're not going to honor the contract, you're just stuck because they'll find some little something. Well, it's got this disease or it's got that, so that they can get around it in court. If you buy carrots at the grocery store, there's only two carrot processors in the United States anymore. Every carrot goes through those two places. If you don't please those two guys or those two companies, you don't sell carrots. Now, I'm talking about to the large supermarkets where normally we'd buy. If you go to your little farmer's market, well, those carrots may be grown locally or whatever. But as far as just looking at the bulk of what people would have to buy, for us, back there where no carrots are grown, other than what somebody might grow in their garden, if you go to the store and buy carrots, it comes from one of two big companies. Most of those companies are out of California. I have nothing against California companies. We work with a lot of them. And I'll tell you, some of those companies do look for quality. But they only look for it in terms of if it will help solve a disease or something like that. Most farmers tell us when they first begin working with us on our program that they can't afford to spend any more than is necessary to produce an adequate yield. They said, all we want to do is just make enough yield so that we can pay our bills and keep going. Because if they spend extra and then you get a bad year or the prices go down, that little bit extra that they spent may be just enough so that they don't get it, not that it's going to break them, but they don't get enough income so that the banker that they get the loan to plant their next crop from says, you didn't make enough income last year, it's not safe to make you another loan. So it really isn't a matter all the time that it's the farmer's attitude. It's a matter, what does the farmer have to do in order to stay in business? And I'm not taking up for the farmer. I'm just trying to show we've got a vicious cycle going here. In addition, it's been drilled into the farmers' heads that they can't afford the fertility it requires to make both top yields and top quality. And I'm going to tell you that that's what we teach farmers, that you can do it. And the ones who do it finally wind up being the ones who do the best. But what they're told is you can't afford to feed the soil and build it up for growing the healthiest, most nutritious plants. It's cheaper to buy just enough to grow the crop, get the yield you want, grow bulk, forget about quality. And as some consumers think, nothing tastes good anymore. Well, we have a church member back in our area that used to grow watermelons, and he did it all organically. He used cottonseed meal for his nitrogen rather than commercial nitrogen. Most watermelon growers pour on huge amounts of nitrogen because that makes bulk. That gives you big melons and weighs more. You can always tell if they use too much if you buy a watermelon and the meat around the rind is nice and red, but right down the middle is a white streak. That means they use way too much nitrogen. They're getting the big size, but they're not getting the quality. But at any rate, one of our neighbors, from that church member who lives about 60 miles away, I brought home some watermelons. And I took them to one down and to him, and they weren't at home, so I just put it by his back step. Next morning, he was knocking on the door early, and he said, "Where did you get that watermelon?" I said, "Well, I got it from Ed that works on our program down 60 miles away." And he said, "I haven't tasted a watermelon like that since I was a little kid." He said, "You know, I always thought my taste buds had gotten worn out, because I could remember how those watermelons tasted when I was a little kid, and I haven't tasted one like that in years, since I was a kid." And he said, "For the first time ever, you brought a watermelon that tastes like it did back then." Well, it's because of the way they're grown. Basically, if you grow the melons and put the right stuff there, they'll still taste good. Well, we as consumers, though, get less and less as far as taste, but even worse, poorer and poorer quality and nutrition. They tell me, and I haven't verified this that every time this happens, but on the average, and we work with a lot of lettuce growers, both organic and conventional, but the commercial producers that produce a head of just regular head lettuce like you buy in the store, on the average, it's sprayed 29 times to keep the bugs and the diseases off between the time they plant it and the time they harvest it. 29 sprays. Why? Because if they don't meet a certain standard, they can't sell it to the buyer from the grocery store, you know, that sells to the grocery store. So it's got to have, it's got to look good enough if it's got some kind of blemish or whatever. You know, if we go to the garden, we find a little piece that's bad, well, you can take it off and still you know where it came from, but that doesn't work in the store. But this concept, how much can we get and how little can we give, doesn't stop at agriculture. It permeates the whole business world. In our work with natural growers and so forth, we came across a material that's made by a company out of Texas, and it's a natural insect repellent. It works on snow scale on peaches. It works on alfalfa weevil. It works on wireworm in corn. It repels mosquitoes. If you actually get a mist blower and mist it out in the trees and so forth, it'll repel mosquitoes for 3 weeks. They'll just leave, won't come back. Now, there are lots of people that hear about that and they'll say, "Well, this ought to be, you know, this will repel mosquitoes for 3 weeks. It's not poison. It's a repellent. Malthion is a poison. When they spray malthion for mosquitoes in all the cities to control mosquitoes, it gets rid of them for 3 weeks, then they got to spray again. One's a poison, one's not." When people hear about this, they think, "Well, this is a great material. Let's just take this to our city council or whatever, and we'll get this changed." I've known about guardar. The material is called guardar. I've known about this since 1978. I don't know one city that's changed from then until now. No matter how concerned they say they are about the environment, they've already got a contract with somebody to spray that malthion. Somebody's making money on it. And there's not a one that's ever switched from one to the other. And I don't know how much the malthion costs, but to spray this repellent costs $1 an acre. You can count on the malthion costs a lot more than that. But because of all the arrangements that people have, you know, about the somebody's got a contract. At any rate, when you hear about ecology and the environment, it always works well if it goes along with politics and money. But if you don't get all four of those working together, it doesn't work so well. Though they tout that they are concerned about the environment, doesn't always mean they're going to use what's most environmentally safe. Years ago, I had after learning about this material, I had the opportunity to work with the former governor of Pennsylvania, Governor Milton Schaap, and his Secretary of Agriculture, Jim McHale. Two guys that carried pretty good weight, you know. I mean, Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Pennsylvania and the governor of Pennsylvania, and they were working in agriculture. They were starting to work with environmental agriculture. And they asked me if I would go with them to introduce this to the fellow at that time who was the manager or the head of U.S. Botanic Gardens at the White House. Sprayed, took care of all the flowers and so forth, and they said, this would be great for the environment. When we got there and showed the material to this fellow that was in charge, he looked at that and said, oh, yeah, that'd work. And I was a little bit shocked. I said, well, it sounds like you're familiar with this material. He said, I am. He said, everybody in the industry knows about this material. The same stuff that I was talking about you could use to repel mosquitoes for 3 weeks. He said, everybody knows about it. I said, everybody knows about it, and it's so cheap. Why is it that everybody's not using it? He said, because you can't patent it. He said, it's a commonly known material, and you can't patent it. And he said, if you can't patent it, you can't sell it in the U.S. marketplace. He said, everything that's sold in the marketplace in the United States has to be marked up at least 10 times before it can get through all the channels to get marketed in the way we market in the U.S. So we are, you know, by setting up the kind of system that we have to go through the supermarkets and Walmart and so forth, we're actually setting ourselves up where everything has got to cost so much. For what? So everybody's looking to push it down on this end, and how much can you, you know, how much can you push it in? I actually was involved with working with a company back in the Midwest. It was called Helena Chemical Company, and they sell farm chemicals. But I wasn't working with them on the farm chemical side. I was working with them because we were trying to establish a fertilizer program for them to use on some of their accounts, and we have through California and Arizona, which we have quite a few organic growers that we work with out there. And anyway, this vice president was talking to me about ag chemicals, and there was one, and I don't remember what it was, but he said, they won't be selling that one in the ag industry next year. They weren't marketing that as such, but a farm chemical company was, and he said, they won't be selling that next year. I said, well, why do you say that? And he said, they can't make enough money on it. They're not able to sell it for enough money. I said, well, what do you mean? That's pretty high-priced material. He said, every farm chemical company in the United States is owned by a pharmaceutical company. He said, the pharmaceutical companies own all the farm chemical companies. It may be that's through some holding company or something like that, but he said, a pharmaceutical company has a rule. They've got to make 40% return on their investment or they won't keep a product. So what he was saying is, if you can't make 40%, then a pharmaceutical company is not going to keep it. And I said, well, why would they have to make that much? He said, because their stockholders expect it. And if they don't satisfy their stockholders, it's not going to work. Now, I've spent this time introducing this, and that was my introduction, but I'd like to ask, what about us? What about myself? What about you? What should be our attitude when it comes to what we do in life? As Mr. Herbert Armstrong used to teach over and over, true love is outgoing concern for others. And that should be our attitude. Well, we've talked long enough. Let's look and see what the Bible says. Luke chapter 6 and verse 38. And that's what I want to ask today. What about us? Luke chapter 6 and verse 38. If we don't be careful, we can get sucked into this same attitude in terms of how little can I do and get as much as possible. And that's not what the Bible tells us. That's not what Christ told us here in the example in Luke 6:38. Give and it will be given to you. He says, figure out how we can give. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, this is a promise to all of us, with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. That man down in Mexico that I was telling you about, first of all, when you meet him and you go out on his farm, you find out he's concerned for the land and they grow organic crops, and he says, we'll grow as much organic as we can sell. They grow conventional as well, because he said, you know, it's so big, and what we're doing, as we learn, we want to be more and more sustainable. He said, we want sustainable agriculture, but he said, we have to learn as we go. But the other part is, you could see he cared about the people that were working for him. It wasn't a matter, well, how little can I do? I mean, look at the meals he served. It wasn't, well, let's just give them a little bit of something and then we'll be done with it. But you know what? That man, I don't know that he's ever looked at this scripture. But when I look around and see what he's done and see what happens, he has been exceedingly, if you know the story, and I haven't told you that yet, at age 19, he was in college at Texas Tech. He got a phone call. He and his brother both were there, and he got a phone call, and his father had died unexpectedly of a heart attack at age 50-something. His father was a big egg business and poultry business in Mexico in a big way, and had huge amounts of loans and stuff from banks. And when he died, the banks called all the loans in. They basically, he said, my brother and I went home, but we lost everything other than just a few acres of land. And they started back with those few acres of land, started working, and now at age 45, he has a huge operation, probably worth more than his father's operations were, and his brother, who's in a different aspect, his brother's in ranching, and his brother does just as good a job in ranching as he does in vegetable and fruit production. In fact, his brother is one of the, from maybe you're familiar with it being right here in Albuquerque, but Holistic Management is located, headquartered right here in Albuquerque. Alan Savory Holistic Management, which we do a lot of work with some of their people. And the fellow I'm talking about's brother has actually been selected to use as a model for around the world to teach holistic management courses for cattle raising and so forth. So both of them are doing a good job. But they're examples to me of give and it will be given to you. Because when you see what they have and what they're working with, you can say, well, yes, but they're smart men and so forth. And yes, I believe they are. But also, when you take this attitude, God's going to bless you. And some of the things that he tells you, he's a Catholic. He's not associated with our church at all. But some of the things that he tells you, you know it had to be from blessings. Otherwise, it couldn't have happened that way. At any rate, when we're told here, give and it will be given to you. Some years ago, we started working with a group of Mennonite farmers in southwest Missouri. And there was this one Mennonite farmer. He only made average yields as compared to the other Mennonite neighbors. You know, he made average yields. Basically, most of them made average yields. But when we went in and analyzed his soils, he had the best land of anybody. His soils should have made extra high yields because he had more ability. Those soils had more ability than anybody else's soils in that area. They were the closest to matching to what we call the perfect humus. But he didn't have extra high yields. He only had average yields. His land was the most fertile. It's the most fertile we had checked in all of southwest Missouri. He was a dairy farmer. It wasn't a large farm, maybe 200 or 300 acres. I don't remember now. But it seemed that he should have had much better yields. It's easy enough to think, well, this man must have been lazy. Because when you looked, his house wasn't as well kept as the other Mennonites. His barns were not as kept up as well. They were not all run down, but they didn't look as immaculate as most Mennonites. But he wasn't lazy. He was a hard worker. He worked hard. Not only that, he seemed very happy and his family was happy. It wasn't a matter that they felt like life was down on them or anything. It was a happy family. You see, all the neighbors, because the neighbors were clients of mine too, and all the neighbors said that he was always willing to help everybody else And then once he got everybody else helped, he'd go home and do his own work. Now, did he just happen to get that land that was the most fertile land? Was that an accident, or was that a blessing? Because God says, give and it'll be given to you. He was able to go help everybody else be happy about it and still do as well as anyone else. I didn't go make an issue out of it. You got the best land, you ought to make the most yield. I just told him, you've been blessed with really good land. And we left it at that. Now, we helped him to get his nutrients up because he needed some trace elements and so forth. But some might say that was a waste of good land. I ask you this, was this God's way of making sure the scripture was fulfilled in Luke 6:38? Proverbs 11, verse 25. Proverbs 11, verse 25. The generous soul will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. Those two scriptures go together. And that is, if we think generously, if we act generously, then it's going to come back to us. It's going to come back to us every time. Just over one more chapter, Proverbs 12, verse 14. Proverbs 12, verse 14 says, a man will be satisfied with the good by the fruit of his mouth, and the recompense of a man's hands will be rendered to him. All I'm using these scriptures for right now is to say, if we take the attitude of how much can we do, what can we do to help others, how can we help others, we can't lose. Because God promises, God's given us these promises. So then, again, let's ask the question, what about us? What can we learn in this regard? Well, there's a scripture that's most assuredly to us as members of God's church, as believers in righteousness. And that scripture is in Proverbs 13, verse 21. Proverbs 13, verse 21 says, evil pursues sinners, but to the righteous good shall be repaid. Whatever we do, as far as that, if we, and who else is seeking to be righteous but God's people? To the righteous, good will be repaid. According to God's Word, if we will practice this, we can't lose. We can't lose. We can only benefit. And it isn't just a matter of benefiting here, it's a matter of benefiting whoever it is, whatever we have a chance to, because we benefit others at the same time as we benefit ourselves. What about us? Do we really believe it's more blessed to give than to receive? What about me? What about you? What do I give God? What do you give God? What do I give my family? We all say it this way. Just put your name there. What do I give my family? What do I give my brethren? What do I give my neighbor? What do I give to strangers? When I began to think about first preparing this, it came to mind, but this will be on the Sabbath, and if I say everything that I have in mind to say, there's going to be some negative things come in this. Not negative necessarily, negative toward the brethren, but negative thoughts on the Sabbath. And you know, the Sabbath's a time to be rejuvenated. And so, for years I was hesitant to present what I'm going to present to you today, or what I am presenting to you today. Because I didn't want to bring the negative aspects out on the Sabbath, but you're going to hear some negative things today. But then I remembered where in Isaiah it says, tell us smooth things. tell us the happy thing. Well, everything's not happy. And what I hope we get out of this today, the first portion here is, yes, we need to give, and if we have that attitude, we can get around this situation where how little can I do for how much I receive. But on the other hand, what I'd also like to show you or to help show is, if we solved every major problem in the world, if we solved every major problem we could stop and think about here, there's so much still wrong that if God doesn't come, there's no hope for us. There's so much here, and after the sermon is finished today, this, or the Bible study, whatever you want to call this, I actually prepared it as a sermon. This is actually to say, we need God. It's not trying to be critical of anyone, because some of these things are not going to be solved if God comes back. They're not. I'm going to give you an example of what I call the phosphate story. I work with phosphates all the time. Phosphate is a nutrient that's needed by plants. It helps them establish better root systems. It helps them to grow and mature faster. It helps relieve drought stress, because you got a better root system and you get the nutrients taken up better. And it also helps plants survive cooler temperatures or cooler weather. Also, it provides us with the phosphate we need in our bodies accordingly. The phosphate we need for health. But during the World Wars, phosphate began to be manufactured to build war materials. Huge facilities were constructed, but suddenly when the war was over, what are we going to do with all this phosphate, with all these facilities? Well, phosphate's needed by plants. We can put phosphate on, we grow plants faster. Since the plants need phosphate, let's sell this phosphate to the farmers so they can grow more crops. And it is true. Plants need phosphate. But they can only take it up in certain forms, and the soil can only tolerate certain amounts before we start creating other problems. Namely, too much phosphorus causes sulfur not to be taken up by the plant. Too much phosphorus causes zinc not to be taken up by the plant. And too much phosphorus causes copper not to be taken up by the plant. Plants and animals and humans need sulfur to build certain amino acids. I'll just give you an example. At Big Sandy, Dr. Alan Stout figured out if we put just 20 pounds of elemental sulfur per ton. Now, nobody does this in the U.S. or anywhere else that I know of. But if they'd put 20 pounds of elemental sulfur per ton of cattle feed in the feed for our cattle that we were slaughtering for beef down there, that the flies didn't bother them. 20 pounds of sulfur per ton of feed, and the flies wouldn't be a problem for the cattle. Almost everybody sprays some kind of poison. Well, you know, this was, Ambassador College was an environmental project. How do we solve these problems, still be good for the environment? That 20 pounds of sulfur solved the problem. But why wouldn't it solve the problem for the big feedlots here? Because they don't have the phosphate balance. If you have too much phosphate, the sulfur doesn't work. See, everything comes back to balance again. You got to put the things in the right order. Well, copper is necessary for plants for stalk strength and resilience. You put on too much phosphate and you weaken the plant. It won't stand up as easy. It'll break. A lot of papaya, wherever, whether it's Florida, whether it's Hawaii, a lot of papaya trees will break off about this high off the ground. They just pour on the phosphorus, but they don't have enough copper. It doesn't give it enough resilience, and it'll break off. They'll lose their papaya tree. And it doesn't have to be the strongest of winds. It just be a wind that just bends it enough to cause it to break on over. For humans, copper is necessary for control of muscle and bone inflammation. If you have inflammation of the muscle or the bone, copper is one of the things that, and it's the one that's generally missing for muscle and bone inflammation. In other words, someone gets hurt, they break an arm or they pull a muscle or something, it just keeps bothering them and bothering them. Some people get over it and some people don't. The people who get over it have the right form of copper in their system to help overcome that inflammation. The people who don't, most people don't. most soil, we check soils from all over the world, almost all soils are deficient in copper. Besides, so many of the soils that grow vegetables and fruits are excessive in phosphorus. So we have a phosphate excess and a copper deficiency, which makes it even worse. You don't even get as much copper as would normally be the case. Not only that, the mines where phosphorus is produced have radioactive uranium in the deposits that are removed. They take the phosphate from it, so the phosphate's processed out. But there are those who study pollution that say, once the phosphate mines are mined out, and then they're left to themselves, that will be the largest environmental hazard we'll face in the United States. Now, that's going to be an environmental hazard simply because of all the residues that are still there, because it's just piled up and left. But in the process of all this happening, as long as the money's there, nothing's going to happen. As long as the money's there, it'll be kept under containment or whatever. But as soon as the money's gone, then it'll be time to come in and clean it up. I have a family of clients down in Florida, and they are not church members again, but you would think they were, you know, just because of the way they conduct their business and how they do things. I think people like that, once they learn the real truth and what God expects of them, probably will do a better job than I do. But, you know, right now they haven't been called. But the father of this family told me this story himself. He said he was 70 years old at the time he was telling me this, which was about 5 years ago. He said, when I first started working, my brother and I owned a farm right down here in Florida. He said, one year we planted corn and the corn started to die, and something was wrong with it, nothing like we'd ever seen before. So we called the university and they came out and looked at it and they started studying it, and they called the state people and they started studying it, and they called the USDA and they started studying it. And he said, all of them came back and said, this is fluoride toxicity. You got fluoride that's killed your corn. Well, where did it come from? Well, they just opened up the phosphate mines. And it was coming out of smokestacks from the phosphate mines. So he said, well, you know, what are we going to do about it? Well, they started looking around. And then all of a sudden, he said, I got a call from the local people. They said, we're not sure that's fluoride toxicity. And then the state people called, we're not sure that's fluoride toxicity. And then the USDA people called and said, we're not sure it's a fluoride toxicity after all. And he said, now all these guys start backing up. But he said, then one night telephone rang and I answered the phone and he said there was a voice on the other end I didn't recognize, and it said, you don't know who I am, you won't know who I am, but tomorrow you're going to get an offer for your farm, and if you know what's good for you, you'll sell it. And just in case you wonder what will happen otherwise, you won't be around to enjoy anything. He said, that's what they told me on the phone. They called my brother and told him the same thing. He said, we sold our farm and moved away and bought something somewhere else. Now, what happened there, you know, as far as the phosphate fertilizer, well, that's one side of the story, but that's when it first really began as far as the war materials and so forth. Well, now it's still sold as fertilizer, and there's another aspect of phosphate fertilizer. Phosphate as a fertilizer is in one form. Phosphate that the plant can use is a different form. And I went to a doctor because I had what I thought were some stomach problems, and I went to be checked out, and he told me I didn't have stomach problems, but he said, we measure for toxicities and allergies and viruses. And I had a phosphate toxicity in my liver. Now, I grew up on a farm. We used commercial phosphates. I asked him, though. I said, well, you know, I've got one, but my wife doesn't. She grew up on a farm, too. But her father never used commercial fertilizer. He said, Almost every person that grew up on a farm that walks into this office has a phosphate toxicity in their liver. Husband and wife. He said, if you lived on the farm where it's been used... Now, he said, I'm not saying that that phosphate toxicity is going to kill everybody, but he said, if you live long enough, that'll be what does you in. So, is phosphate really something we need to go around and use? Well, you know, you won't hear that from an average medical doctor. But if somebody starts checking you for toxicities, it might be something that you might look into. That's not the only toxicity that I had. I also have atrazine and 2,4,5-T in my liver. Atrazine is a spray that was used on the crops in our area. And, well, let me just say it this way. 2,4,5-T, I never thought I was around. And for years I wondered where I got it. Until I was talking to one of the aerial applicators in our area, and he said, well, we found out that if you're spraying anything that's going to kill weeds, if you'll put just a little bit of 2,4,5-T in it, that's Agent Orange that they use in Vietnam. If you put just a little bit of 2,4,5-T in it, it'll work better. And all those fields I'd been going out checking where those airplanes had come and sprayed had 2,4,5-T. Well, there was enough. Even though they said, well, it's just a little amount, there was enough that it still showed up in my liver. So, I'm not trying to say these things to scare anyone. I'm just saying that all the different kind of problems that we're getting into, how long is it going to take to solve? Because that phosphate that's been spread out on the farms, that's not... We use moderate amounts of phosphates in the Midwest. The real big phosphate users are the vegetable and fruit producers who produce what we're eating out of the supermarket. I mean, when we check, after I leave on vacation, I'm actually going on to California to work with a grower that raises 14,000 acres of vegetables, and 7,000 acres of them are organic. But on all those organic and conventional acreages, they have phosphate toxicities. They have way too much phosphate, simply because they can't get enough phosphorus into the plant. And they keep putting on more phosphorus trying to raise the phosphate levels. And the more you put on doesn't raise the phosphate level in the plant, because that's not the key. The key is they don't have other nutrients there to get the phosphate to be utilized properly. So again, we've built up phosphate toxicities to the point that it also doesn't get enough sulfur in, doesn't get enough zinc in, doesn't get enough copper in. Well... when it comes down to all these various things, the petroleum side of it, and I'm not talking about the high price of gas or anything else, but I didn't come prepared today, so I don't have it to read from, but I normally read from a section in World Crisis in Agriculture. That's a booklet that was put out by the church years ago through the Agriculture Department of Big Sandy. It's not available anymore. It's out of print. But in World Crisis in Agriculture, there's a part on sick soil. And it talks about these various things that are happening and so forth. And we actually, in 1968, when I was at Big Sandy, had an opportunity to travel up to Columbia, Missouri, close to where I live now. Well, it's the university where I met Dr. Albrecht. And we went to the Fisheries and Wildlife Research Facilities there, because they had done research on DDT, and that was right at the time when it was coming out about how dangerous DDT was. Well, when we got there, Mr. Dale Scherter asked the director, well, you know, were you surprised about this material on DDT? And he said, we've known that for 25 years. He said, we've got published papers on this for 25 years, but he said nobody would pay any attention until the movie stars started. You know, somebody had to get the attention. And he said, when the movie stars started saying this DDT's hurting, then it got the press interested. And when the press started getting interested, well, then all of a sudden it got out. But he said, we knew 25 years ago. This was 1968. But as we were sitting there, let me just tell you why they're located where they are. Because atrazine is one of the things that reminds me of this. They're located there because they found a source of water 1,500 feet underground that had no contamination at all. It was pure, pure water. And they said, to do the research we're doing, we need pure water. And what they did was they would take fish, and they were, this was a part of the U.S. Forestry Service, Fisheries and Wildlife, and they would put these fish in a little, what they called a stress tunnel. It was water running through, and they'd put a big trout about so long in there. And up here at the front, there was wire mesh, so he couldn't swim through. At the back, they had two little sensors, and if his tail got back there, it'd shock him. So he couldn't get lazy and start to slow down. So he had to swim as fast as they put the water through. And they said, what we do is we test these fish for 3 days because they'll burn up their fat. And then we test what's being released out of the fat because the poisons are stored in the fat. We test what's being released out of the fat into the fish because then we can get an idea of what's going to happen to people. Well, they were, in this particular test, they were testing three different herbicides that it was Eldrin and Dieldrin and one other, and I think the other was atrazine, I'm not sure. But they were all being added into the water at the same amount as gets in streams when the farmers spray and then it rains and then the runoff with the soil and everything gets a little bit of this material in. Not enough to kill anything, but it gets a little bit of all of it in there. And they said, we put the trout in and started to do the stress test, and they said, we have pure water. We bought altogether pure organically grown feeds, no sprays, no anything. The feed's pure. And we buy fish from only three hatcheries in the United States because there are only three hatcheries in the United States that the water's not so contaminated that the fish, even from the fish hatcheries, are contaminated. This was in 1968. There were only three fish hatcheries in the United States they could buy fish from that weren't contaminated. So, I mean, I don't know if you still can or not because I haven't been there since. But at any rate, they said we had a fish that wasn't contaminated, we had water that wasn't contaminated, and the food source was not contaminated. And yet, with the control fish that we started out with so that we could make sure we had something to go by, when we checked the control fish, they were contaminated. Well, he said, we got that solved, and I'll come back and tell you that answer in a minute. He said, we got that solved, and then we put that fish in the stress tunnel, and once we eliminated the contamination, we found out that those fish with those three combinations, and that's three combinations out of, at that time, there were 600 different chemicals that were used in agriculture in 68, and there's a lot more now. But this was just three of them getting into the water with the normal levels that would be sprayed on fields to coming into the water supply. And they said normally a fish will use up its fat reserves. But they said, when you put these three in the water, it's so poison to the fish that the body of that fish somehow tells, that something in that fish tells it, don't use that fat. And the fish, instead of using the fat, actually starts drawing upon its and using its muscle tissue instead of fat. And it'll actually start to decompose its own muscle to live on instead of the fat. Now, he said, that's just from these three in terms of light contamination. And he said, we haven't really solved, you know, when you start putting all these things together, how long is it going to be before, well, you know, the poisons are stored in the fat. And who knows what's, you know, who knows what all's going to happen. But at any rate, let's go back now. They found the last source of contamination was the plastic pipe that brought the water into the fish. They actually had in that plastic pipe, and he said, what's in that plastic pipe is more poisonous to us, pointing to us sitting in that room, than DDT. He said, it's more poison than DDT. He said, when you get into the car and put your hands on the steering wheel, if it feels sticky, that's that poison. It's coming out of the plastics. He said, the softer the plastic, the more poison you're going to get. He said, if you get the real hard plastic, you know, the real hard plastic that most people use for plumbing, you don't get any contamination out of that really hard plastic. But he said, it's that soft pliable. Anything that's plastic that's soft and pliable, the more pliable it is, the more poison you get from it. Now, you know, that could be, you know, we can say, well, we live with plastics all the time, and we do. But I'll give you an example of what happened at Big Sandy, because we had whole milk. You know, we sold whole milk. We didn't have to pasteurize it, homogenize it, or anything else. We were the only dairy in the state of Texas that was allowed to do that because we had our own resident veterinarian and we met all the qualifications that they had. Well, those little quart glass bottles that we put the milk in got to be harder and harder and harder to find. And so finally the decision was made, we'll go to plastic bottles. When we went to plastic bottles, now the milk was not homogenized, so you know, when in those little glass bottles, well, all the cream came to the top and you could use it for whipped cream or butter or whatever. Well, cream still came to the top in those plastic ones, but all the ladies started complaining, you can't get whipped cream, you can't make this. What's the matter with the milk anymore? Well, it turns out, this was before we went to up to that place. But even at that point, when we switched back to glass, it would whip and it would make butter again. Well, what was happening is there's enough poisons in that plastic to kill the microbes in the milk that causes it to make butter or to whip for whipped cream. Now, if you wonder about that, when you go to the grocery store, if you ever go to buy whipping cream, see what they put it in. I don't think you'll ever find one in a plastic container. And it's in those little cardboard, because that doesn't have the exudate in it. But what's most milk sold in the store? Plastic cartons. Now, the harder it is, the less you get from it. But I mean, those plastic cartons that we bought were enough to kill the microbes in that milk so that it would not whip for cream or it would not make butter anymore. But how can you know if you're buying it in a store because it's already pasteurized and homogenized, you're not going to have any cream come to the top to make any butter or whipped cream out of it anyhow. And I'm not even saying that the companies that market it even know it. I don't know if they know it or not. But I will say that, you know, when it comes down to plastic, how are we going to solve that problem? We can do everything we want. We can do everything we can do. We're not going to solve that problem. Not till God comes. You know, it's just a matter to say that this world is in such a mess. When you start looking at 600 sprays, even if we all start eating as organic as we can, and I believe in organics and that I have an organic garden, but I also will tell you I work with a lot of farmers who are not organic and who use sprays and so forth. Every one of them would get rid of them tomorrow if they knew how. They just don't know how to do it. And the other part of it is it would cost them a lot of money that they don't have to do it. And we can go out and do all we can do. We can make a little bit of difference. But all the other people who don't understand are not going to do it. And so what I'm saying is, this situation that we have gotten ourselves into, until everybody understands that principle of give, it's not going to be solved. It's not going to be solved. The DDT, the chemical sprays and the plastics alone are enough to cause the problems, let alone the phosphate contamination. And I can tell you that isn't the only contamination. That's just one. The fertilizer industry, even though they may not feel like they're doing anything, the fertilizer industry and the agriculture is causing us problems that we're not going to get solved until God comes back. I mean, I can help people work with what they've got, but there are some problems we just have to say, you know, that's so overdone you can't do anything about it. Proverbs 17, verse 23. Proverbs 17, verse 23 says, a wicked man accepts a bribe behind the back to pervert the ways of justice. The reason I say we can't do anything about it is because there are too many people who don't really care. There are too many people who will, for money, they'll do whatever is necessary. That same family that I mentioned in Florida that had the father that got called in terms of they had to sell the farm and move away, they found out that there was they actually sell phosphate fertilizers. But they found out that there was a chemical that was being sold on the market, and there was a special phosphate that was in that chemical. It was sold to control rust in fruits and vegetables. And the father, the fellow who was telling me about moving away, told everybody that's a phosphate response. They're getting that through a real effective phosphate. They're getting some kind of phosphate into the plant. And they started investigating into it, and sure enough, they were using phosphate as a carrier and then putting a poison in, and the poison was given credit for killing the rust, and it was the phosphate that was doing it all the time. The poison wasn't killing it at all. You could do it without the poison. When they found that out and said, well, we can just sell this just as a straight phosphate fertilizer instead of selling it with the poison on it to get rid of the rust, the chemical company took them to court. And the judge said, you can't even say, even though this has been established as the truth, until the patent runs out, you can't even say that. And if you do, we'll get you for contempt of court and put you in jail. So here they were told, because this company has lots of money. And they said, until that happens, when the patent ran out, then they thought, well, because it ran out about 6 years ago, they thought, well, now we'll be able to go ahead and use this. And, well, it's going to destroy that other company's reputation if somebody can find out you can do it without using the poison in it. So when they went out to sell it, well, they got taken to court again. And these fellows are educated enough. They presented a court case, and they won the court case. They won the court case. But the men who were doing the research at the universities, the men that were actually doing the research that were saying it was working, everybody, all their superiors and stuff, started backing down and saying, well, maybe this is not really doing what it's supposed to do anyway. Even though they won the court case, now all of a sudden the experts started saying, well, maybe this really isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. And so they went to one of the universities. They had a big banquet for everybody that was supporting their research. And he said, we came in, and they said, everybody between 25 and 50,000 stand up. And he said, our little 30,000 research, well, we stood up with most of the people in the room. We all sat down, and then between 50 and 100 stood up, and between 100 and 500,000 stood up. And he said, there was still one man still not standing up. And he said, after everybody sat back down, the guy said, well, now we have one person here that we want to acknowledge their company, because they didn't tell us we had to use this money in any kind of a way. They just donated $1 million to the department to be used in any way we want. And it was the company. It was the company that owned that material. And now all of a sudden the university was saying, well, we're not sure it works anymore. Well, they had court cases and they had hearings, and they called all these experts in to testify. 2 years after it's over, the family gets a call from one of the professors at one of the universities, and he said, that was the best presented court case I've ever seen. And he said, I just wanted to tell you that if you ever need somebody to do some experimental work for you, I'd be interested in doing it. Well, they did hire him to do some experimental work because he was well known and so forth. But I'm telling you this because after they'd known him for a couple of years, one of the men was sitting with him at breakfast one morning, and he said, I felt like I knew him well enough. And said, I just looked him in the eye and it said, when you got up on that court, when you got up on that stand in court, what you said, you had to know that wasn't the truth. And the guy said, yes, I lied. And he said, every other professor that got up there on that stand knew he was lying. He said, every one of us knew we were lying. But he said, you know, when your boss comes to you and says, these people pay us this much money, we got to have that stay in operation, and you know that if you don't get up there and say that, you're going to lose your job because they pay me a whole lot less than what those people are contributing to the operations. He said, you'll get up and say whatever you need to say. Now, all I'm saying is that when it comes right down to what we're hearing today, the bribes and so forth that are going on, it isn't a matter that what we're hearing is what's the best for us anymore. We see this all the time. We see it all the time. And Mr. Herbert Armstrong said years ago, I keep coming back to things he said, but I mean, I can't help it. He tell in his autobiography, you may remember if you read that, about when Mr. Babcock stood up before the Great Depression and he told all the bankers that there were going to be a depression, and they all laughed him out of the room. And a year later, they had him back to ask him how he knew, and he said, when 51% of the people are dishonest, then you can know that that's what's going to happen. Well, I saw a poll that was done. It was published in Parade magazine 5 years ago or so. And they asked people all over the United States, is there anything you wouldn't do for $1 million? And 51% said there was nothing they wouldn't do for $1 million. All I'm saying is I don't know. I don't know what's holding things together, but I don't think it's because more than 50% of the people are honest anymore. I'm sorry, I just don't think it is. I think that God has something that He still wants to accomplish, and that's why things are still holding together. But when you start looking at all the things that can happen, there are so many ways, that things can crash down around us. All I would say is, if we practice, we can make a little bit of difference if we practice ourselves just and ask ourselves, what can we give? What can I give? What can you give? Whether it be to the neighbor, whether it be to anyone else. Whatever we do, we'll make that much difference. And what difference is being made? God's waiting for something. And if we don't make the difference, who's going to? So I ask you again, what about us? And I'd like to close with Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 18. Therefore, the Lord will wait that He may be gracious to you. God is being gracious, and He's being gracious to us and to many more. And therefore, He will be exalted that He may have mercy on you. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all those who wait for Him. And that's all we can do. We can do our best to claim God's promise, give what we can give, do what we can do for others, and wait, because God is going to have to be the one who solves these problems. Otherwise, everybody's going to have to be converted before He comes, and I don't think that's going to happen.